When I invited Samora Pinderhughes and Jack DeBeau to talk to me last January, I didn't know exactly what to expect. Despite their longstanding collaborative relationship, the two of them had never done an interview together, and I was curious to see how the energy between them would unfold. I was very pleased by how it went. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Samora Pinderhughes is a pianist, a composer, a singer, and a multidisciplinary artist. He makes music with a certain gravity to it. It deals with weighty, often difficult themes, incarceration, mental health, structural violence. His work asks us to reckon with uncomfortable truths about our own world, and it does so with a sense of purpose and intention. But in person, Samora is funny, lighthearted, and full of life. It's a reminder that to laugh is not a dismissal of hardship, but a reclamation of power and presence in the face of it. Jack DeBeau, a drummer and producer, has a big hand in the process too. Samora and Jack's relationship is built on trust and experimentation, and their creative dynamic is as playful as it is profound. Over the years, they've worked together on various projects, including Samora's recent album, Venus Smiles, Not in the House of Tears. Inertia. Call my name, inertia. It's all a game to you. Don't you see what you put me? And on The Healing Project. That's a multidisciplinary initiative that combines music, visual art, and storytelling to address the far-reaching impact of the carceral system. Samora's commitment to social justice is not something he stumbled upon by accident. It was instilled in him from a very early age. Both of his parents have spent their lives doing transformative work in communities affected by violence. That upbringing shaped his perspective and eventually his work as an artist. But it wasn't until he met and worked with theater artist Anna Deavere Smith that he began to understand how to take his ideas and transform them into something bigger, something multimedia and multifaceted. Anna encouraged him to look beyond the typical constraints of music making and storytelling, and in doing so, helped inspire the expansive vision of The Healing Project. That vision doesn't only include people who are currently incarcerated, it's about the ripple effects that incarceration has on families, communities, and individuals, those who experience structural violence, displacement, and trauma in all its forms. Death is much worse for the ones left behind. Don't leave me alone with my dreams. I might go crazy this time. For Samora, the work is as much about listening as it is about creating. He conducted hundreds of interviews with people who have been affected by the carceral system, and those stories became the foundation for the music, the visual art, and the performances that make up The Healing Project. Presenting material like this in a way that invites people in without overwhelming them has been one of Samora's biggest challenges, and it takes a lot of patience. These are slow-moving, deliberative projects that require introspection and consideration. At the same time, for Jack and Samora, the creative process begins playfully and spontaneously. In contrast to the deeply intentional and patient nature of The Healing Project, Samora and Jack's album, Venus Smiles, Not in the House of Tears, was born out of a very organic, exploratory process. Jack talks about their early days of collaborating as playful and free, two friends sitting in a room with a keyboard, some percussion instruments, and a willingness to try anything. That spirit of openness led to a body of music that grapples with themes of mental health and societal pressure. And Pinderhughes sees the work as an effort to bridge those personal and collective aspects. The dialogue between public and personal experiences, the collective and the individual, seems to be at the heart of Samora's thinking, which may help to explain why he is equally at ease talking about his own struggles as he is about larger structural questions. To live a successful creative life, he says, is not only to do meaningful work, but also to live sustainably and to stay healthy. These are serious artists making serious work, yes, but they do it with a lightness and a playfulness that is infectious. It's a reminder that art, even when it confronts the heaviest of themes, can still be a source of joy. Jack and Samora are creating work that speaks to the present while imagining a more hopeful future. We got together earlier this year at the Winter Jazz Fest for a conversation about art and life, struggle and joy, and the power of collaboration to transform not just the work, but the people who make it. This is also a good opportunity for me to let you know that I'll be back at the Winter Jazz Fest in New York on January 9th, 10th, and 11th of 2025, doing more interviews and live streams in collaboration with WBGO. Because, as you may know, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios, and you can visit wbgo.org/studios anytime to check out all of their award-winning work. And you can even check out their non-award-winning work, too. If you want to keep up on my movements, thoughts, writings, general output, please subscribe to the Substack. It's leosidran.substack.com, and there you will receive a notification every time a new episode is released. Of course, I encourage you always to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you do your podcast things. Leave reviews, tell friends, rate it, love it, do all the things. And remember, third-story.com is like the gallery of The Third Story. Every episode going back to the very beginning of time is there, and you can check out previous conversations in the archive with friends and contemporaries of Jack and Samora's, like Louis Cato, Riley Mulherker, Vijay Iyer, Jose James, and many more. Here's Jack DeBow, Samora Pinder-Hughes, and me talking it down at Winter Jazz Fest earlier this year.
You got the only thing that I'm sorry to say is that we have two microphones between the three of us.
That's okay.
You like each other.
Yeah, we were in a sweaty dressing room yesterday. Yeah. We was going to give each other something. It's been happening.
And the other thing I'll say about this, Samora and Jack, is that I asked you two to come together, and I'm not entirely sure why. But it seemed to make sense.
Exactly.
And so it's really casual. Today we're going to be casual, and there's nothing off limits.
I don't think we've ever done an interview together, have we?
We have not.
Speaking to the microphone.
We have not.
Ooh. Turn my mic up.
We have not.
This is why.
This is why. You never have. So you played last night. I didn't get a chance to see it. I'm sorry. So I'd like you to take me through how the performance was.
It was wonderful. It was very special for me because I hadn't, you know, done a performance in a little bit.
Why is that? That 6 months you said that you hadn't performed.
Yes, yes. I had to have emergency surgery. I won't go into it because I like to be a little bit private about those things. But I had to recuperate for a while and cancel everything for a bit and do some rehab. But I'm fully recovered, happy to say, and I'm back. And I think better than ever, feeling really great. And yeah, you know, just really hungry to be back creating, because I think that 6 months of not creating, because I really was just totally in the rehab process.
Playing on your own, alone?
I couldn't even play.
Couldn't play.
I couldn't play. Until about 2 months ago, I couldn't play. That's why I had to just cancel everything and just focus on recovery. But I've been, you know, playing to getting up to performance, but you can't replicate the energy of performance and practice as much as you practice, you know. So it was definitely, I think, you know, the most, like, it felt the most like a reintroduction in many years of just, like, being back on stage. I think that's the longest I hadn't played a show, probably since I was, like, 7 years old.
Well, did it feel different coming back to playing after taking the time off?
It did feel different, mostly just, and again, this could definitely be, I'm sure a lot of people had this experience, you know, moving through the pandemic and stuff, is just that the biggest difference is just the appreciation I had for being able to do it and the ability to be present in a way that I think, you know, sometimes can get lost when you're just constantly doing the thing. You know, I mean, this is obviously what we do for a living. So there's a certain way where even though it's magical every time, it does become normalized in your body. And so to like have that shift, you really, you know, you're just grateful for the all of the experience, particularly just, I mean, number one, being able to do it, but also just having people be present, you know, feeling that exchange, which, like you're saying, you can't replicate that in an isolated context.
Yes.
And then, I mean, the best thing for me is just being with my friends. And I'm lucky as a person that I create music with my community, with my best friends in the world. So just being able to be together is nothing like that.
And you create large scale pieces also. You create, you know, your project tends to involve...
It's a lot of people.
A lot of people.
Yeah, we do a lot of people, which is funny because like in me and Jack, you know, Jack, we create a lot of the music together. And like when we're making it, it's not necessarily always with everybody together. It tends to just have everybody ends up on the material. But when we're making it, it is a little bit more of like a puzzle pieces thing. So when we get to performance and we get to like do it with, yeah, I mean, yesterday I think we had 14 on stage. Like, you know, it's
a lot,
a
mostly
thing.
Singers, and then the, it's like a lot of singers, and then you have the
rhythm
section.
Yeah, 4-person rhythm section, yeah. And then everybody else is singers.
What is the rehearsal process of putting together a 14-person show? Also, with singing, it's not quite as casual as being able to invite a bunch of, you know, soloists
Master
or whatever
musicians.
People that can kind of fit in. I mean, that you have to really align. What is that like, putting that together?
Yeah, well, I'm lucky. Again, another thing, I'm very lucky. I have a choir director who also does all, like works on all the vocal arrangements with me. Her name's Neo Levon. Actually, met her like through Jack in a very like fortuitous situation, which actually was like literally we were looking for somebody to kind of play that role and help like expand out the vocal world of the music that we were making. And I was like, Jack, send me some great people. And then I went out for the night and like went to some shows and like kind of turned off my phone. And I went to this event and heard her sing and was like super moved by it. And we met that night. And then I turned my phone back on and he had sent me her name.
Oh.
Sent me their name. Yeah. So it was pretty crazy. But that's like one of my very core collaborators, Neo Levon. And she does all of the vocal arranging for live performance. So basically the two of us, we get together before any show, prep all the music, talk through like, this is how we want all the material to go. And then she's kind of really in charge of doing the things you're talking about, which is just like getting really deep into the specifics of the material. And she's like, just masterful at it. And then we're able to kind of just go with the, you know, the rest, the big picture, rhythm section, shaping the material, arrangements. But it's also just like a very fun process. We don't take it too serious.
That's so interesting. Okay, so let's get Jack DeBow involved in this conversation now. How did you guys meet? What's the nature of your relationship? Why are you friends? How did you, what's the story?
We met on a sort of odd one-off gig with Emily King. We didn't see each other for a while after that, but I think I'd worked on some music for an artist named Solo Woods that made its way around the community, and Samora heard it, and we connected at another friend's birthday party, mutual friend's birthday party, and he said, let's work together. So we would get together at my place, my apartment, and just the two of us on some rickety percussion or like, you know, busted up MIDI keyboard and controller or something, yeah. And just sort of come up with ideas and play together freely. And Samora at the time had some already sort of constructed some great ideas, and we just had a great rapport bouncing these things off of each other. And then he would take them home and he would write melody and lyrics and just bring them to lift them to a whole nother level. And then eventually we'd get together in a practice room and play through it some more, and we just kept bouncing ideas. And I think it was really just a fun process for both of us. It was like being a kid again, which is something I'm always trying to look for.
You're trying to get to, get right, back yeah. there. I think it's so interesting because the music, the content is heavy often and serious. I think I read a quote of yours where you said you want people to think differently after they've engaged with the music. You're trying to change people's, maybe not their minds, but maybe their perception of certain issues that are going on in the world. And yet there's an enormous levity talking to both of you. There's a lightness and a kind of a humor and a, like, not taking it too seriously, which, you know, I could easily see you coming in here with like a very heavy energy and saying like, you know, this is very important and we agonize over this. And that's not what I'm feeling from you guys at all.
I think we have our moments in the studio where we come together and sort of share our feelings or enter a sort of emotional space that we relate to. But when it comes to the actual creative process, the things we attach to are the things we see that spark light up in the other person's body language, and the things that we really attach to and get excited about when we're in the studio. Those are the things that I think make are the kernel, each of the songs that make them special. And we just sort of grow from there. There are sort of two major projects that we've been simultaneously working on. And there's one that we started with, where it was the two of us bouncing a lot of these ideas off of each other, that was a really long, arduous process where we were sort of recreating and revisiting and chopping up and reproducing and polishing and over-polishing and going back to the demo. And, you know, really we were exploring and experimenting. And I remember saying some more early on, like, I don't want us to say no to each other. I just want us to say, sure, let's try it. Let's try that and see where it goes. And even if it takes us longer than we would like.
Is that a natural thing for you, or is that something you've had to train yourself to
do? No, I don't think I would do that with everyone. I think I wanted to do that with Samora, and Samora and I were getting so much enjoyment out of it. There were definitely moments where we were like pulling our hair out. We never blamed each other, but we were just like, this is rough. Like, we're filled with frustration. Let's come back to this at a later date. And we would walk away from it and come back to it and were reminded with fresh ears, you know, that there's something special.
And which project is that?
That's Venus project. Venus Smiles Not in the House of Tears.
Correct.
But the other project is the Grief, yes. Or rather the album is Grief, which comes out of the Healing Project.
Yes.
Which Samora can definitely speak on some more. But that process, the process of creating that album was complete opposite from the Venus project, in that Samora called me one day and said, I've got this body of music, we have to record it in like a week. And I said, okay, you know, like, who's playing, you know, what are we doing here, man, you know, what's the plan? He was like, I don't know, but, you know, just trust me, we'll be there, and this is the instrumentation. And that's what happened. We got in the studio, everybody showed up, and we recorded this record in, I think, two or three days, mixed it roughly in like a week, and that was it. And so it was a very different experience, but I think that there was some lessons learned for both of us, and we're happy with the outcome. But most of what the Healing Project is based on, just musically at least, comes from that record, and the choir especially comes out of the making of that album. So,
and that's an album that was first informed by hundreds of hours of interviews that you had conducted with prisoners?
Yeah, so the Healing Project, the community that's built around it is not only structured around people who are incarcerated. It's really about people who have been affected by the carceral experience. So what I mean by that is it does include people who are currently or formerly in prison, but it also includes people who have been affected in other ways, like they have family members who have been incarcerated, young people who have dealt with the court system or juvenile injustice, people who have been in detention, you know, through immigration situation, basically any side of the prison industrial complex, and also deals with structural violence, which is basically like any violence that can be attributed to institutional issues. And that actually includes interpersonal neighborhood-based violence, because in my opinion, and this is also backed up by fact, that's actually, there are structural factors that create that. And that's a very big and important part of the project, is that we have a tendency in the country and really in the world to see certain issues as a product of individual malice or individual, you know, the property being, okay, this is how or what or who this person is, when in reality, it's really, it can be seen as the reaction or the subset of a bunch of different factors coming together. So there's a really big missed opportunity in my eyes for people to understand, number one, how people get into certain situations and what the result is or where they're at, but also to understand that there's a purpose to the distance that is created between the general public and those who are in prison or those who have gone through a subset of experiences that force them to deal with the carceral system. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that many of us can remove ourselves from that, both psychologically and physically. First of all, we don't have to deal with them because they get sent away somewhere, so we don't have to deal with it.
We don't see it.
But also, it allows the general public to believe that they're morally superior people who would never be put in the position or never be the type of person that would do certain things. And also, it allows the society, and certainly like the government and corporations and things like that, to also place themselves in those same moral positions where even though they're murdering people, committing crimes, doing all this stuff, they are not considered to be people that would be on the same plane as the people that we put in prison. So,
how did you get interested in this particular question, and how did you come to decide that you would like this to be one of the leading sort of artistic projects that you wanted to do?
It was kind of like a lifelong thing. It's almost like, I know certain artists have said, like, oh, I know I wanted to make this record when I was like 20, but yeah. I had to make other records first to get to that.
Yes.
And it kind of was like that for me, in that I grew up, like, both my parents are inside of that work. My dad does youth violence prevention work and is one of the people that kind of like created the understanding in the field around PTSD. Oh, it's not just soldiers coming back from war. It's really the same thing is happening to people in certain neighborhoods who are subjected to certain kinds of violence. And my mom has a program called Roots of Success, which is taught in the prisons, and she does a lot of freedom work. So I kind of grew up in that, honestly, a lot more than I grew up with music. And so I always knew that I wanted to use my music to approach these societal realities, but I wasn't ready to go there immediately. And I also didn't really have the container. And what happened to give me that was that I was mentored by this amazing theater playwright, filmmaker, genius, visionary, Anna Deavere Smith, and learning under her, seeing her interview-based process, and having her kind of give me the blessing to engage in my own practice around that, that's what enabled me to start the journey of this project. To be honest, it was going to be something totally different. And it was really her belief and vision in me that after I was kind of trying to force it into a certain box of what I understood as a musician, she was like, no, you clearly want to do a lot more with this and you want to take it in a lot of different directions, which you might be scared to go in. But if what, this project
like
is going to work.
More multimedia, more theatrical or in that sense, or more in terms of the scope of what the piece was?
Both. I think, I mean, the immediate was really just like the way that you're doing this, it is too much for 1.5 hour framework to hold. It can work in that context, but it's not going to work this way. And so that kind of opened up my brain to say, yes, there's a performance version of this, which now we're finding and starting to present, but it has to be held in a certain way where it combines the interview material with songcraft and allows it to come alive on stage in a different way. And also that it can be a little bit more experimental, you know, and she kind of was the person that turned me on to a lot of different approaches in that regard, from like a Steve Reich approach with language to like a, you know, Jason Moran's, how he deals with that stuff. She pointed me to a lot of the core material, which is important to me, which is actually music that came from the prisons early in the 1900s. So all these kind of different like formats for this material, it just kind of opened my brain up to be like, oh, okay, I don't have to just have this be 2 straight hours of just people talking. That's just the audience can't handle it. So what I ended up doing was, okay, in performance, we can flip it this way, but the place where we can put that is inside of a physical space. Because when you're inside of exhibition or whatever, any physical space, you can leave and come as you want, you know? And this material, the way it is, it kind of necessitates that, because for some people it's very cathartic, for some people it's very difficult. And so you have to give that allowance for people to be like there for 5 minutes or there for an hour.
Yes, take it in the dose that they can handle.
Yeah, yeah.
We are so accustomed to a certain kind of immediate gratification with projects that we do. There's a beginning and a middle and an end. When we make records and we master it, our job is done as the technical creators of the thing, get the cover art made, make the video, put it up, move on. Is it a difficult shift when you start to realize that a project that you're working on, I mean, I'm obviously talking about an album, I guess, but like, is it a difficult shift when you realize this is ongoing? Mm. I don't even know when we're really done with this. Mm. You have to become very patient with something like that.
Well, the patience is definitely the hardest part for sure. But for me, like overall, it's extremely freeing actually, because it was my natural state, but I just never knew that until I was given the opportunity to investigate that through this project in ways that are still revealing themselves. Like for instance, you know, obviously through the project, you know, I became a visual artist, I became a filmmaker, you know, mostly through collaboration, finding amazing collaborators that allow me to expand in those ways. But now we're even transitioning the project to a full-fledged arts organization where we're actually going to be able to serve even more art to the people, but also engage in freedom campaigns and policy and all these different things that we want to do. But now I'm director of an organization. That's like a whole nother thing that I never, you know, that's a whole nother skill set.
Yeah.
So I'm learning that, you know, again, with a great, great community, great staff, great people around me. But a lot of it is just about, you know, throwing yourself into the deep end. And then the question is, are you ready to engage in the work?
Yeah.
And in the transformative process internally that transformation demands, because it is a different set of practices, you know?
Yeah.
But I find it super freeing, because I just think that it means that the questions and the work is always guiding. It's not, oh, am I going to make another piece of music? I mean, I love music. I'm always a musician first, but it's really just what needs to be done. And then how do we do it? And I love that, because I am a very, in a sense, I think, kind of a practical artist. Like, I'm also love to be the opposite of that and be surreal and be imaginative, but I want things to be of use. So if I'm able to think that way, then I can do whatever. And I think Jack can talk about this too, because I think it also makes room for everyone in the community that's making the work to do that too. I mean, like, I was able to use his skills in ways that I never would have done if we were just doing a record.
Because how so?
Then he was doing 5.1 surround for the exhibition.
Well, right. I mean, again, it's like there's a kind of a functional aspect to what you're doing. You're trying to tell specific stories. You need to achieve specific things. And at the same time, you guys talk about this getting together and just being playful with it. I mean, do you, when you're messing around with this work, is there a point where you go, wait, stop. Is this moving us in the right direction? I mean, it's fun to do this, but is this, can we use this work? Do you allow yourself to be creative and not wonder how it's going to get used?
That's the thing. We kind of like, I don't want to speak for you, but I feel like you feel the same way about this. I look forward to the moments or the days where we plan to get together without any criteria,
yeah,
without any expectations, and just create.
Yeah.
That's where we can be ourselves, most be ourselves and be free. And then we step away from the material for that, after that moment, for a while. And, you know, yeah, it's patience again, you know.
Yeah.
But I think we know now, like, not to overthink things. We give it a certain kind of energy and attention that in that moment, and then we let ourselves rest and come back to it with fresh ears. Samora, in terms of writing, is very prolific. You know, he's always been working on, aside from the Healing Project and Venus, yeah, and all of these other things, he's always written for other artists, you know, and been behind the scenes working on all types of other things. And so there's always sort of like something we find in, you know, most of the material we've created
that you can use, feel
could be used for something. So,
I mean, like he said, I think that's what's wonderful, is that we do get to work on a bunch of different things. Like he said, I mean, one example of that is that we just, we did a score, myself and Chris Padishaw, who's another collaborator of ours. We did a score for this Nikki Giovanni documentary that just came out last week on HBO Max. Uh-huh. Jack mixed that in surround and in 2.0. Stereo, whatever.
2.0.
Like, literally, yeah, this is also, this is good. I'm glad this is why I need him, because I know nothing about that shit. But that was just like a great experience we did together. So we're always doing random things, but I will say that you're right that sometimes that balance can be difficult, because there's always a lot of straight line, okay, like this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
But I still really love engaging in just that creative, yeah, unknown space. And I think that's something we're going to be doing a lot more this year, especially now that we've completed a lot of things either that are kind of ongoing or that will come out in the coming year that we're, yeah, kind of already done with, but we're just figuring out how to release. Yeah, that's the most enjoyable process for sure.
Is it hard to be putting work out that is from a slightly different version of your life? Like, I mean, we all go through this also. You make a thing, and then by the time the cycle, blah, 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 it's 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever. But I mean, how do you, obviously you're excited that it's coming out, but is there a part of you that's also like, I'm actually in a different place right now than I was when I made this thing?
Yeah, I have felt like that at different times. I think now I don't feel that way only because I think I'm starting to see the work in a different way, in the sense that for me, the present moment is about the process. And so I'm always inside of that. But as far as what comes out and what is given to the public, it's just, at that point, it's not mine anymore. And it's new for them, right? It's new for people.
Yes.
And so as long as the material, the real question then becomes, is the work timeless, or can the work still live, or is it stuck in that moment of, yeah, when you created it? And it, if it is, then it probably isn't that, you know, like in my opinion, yeah. I'm not really trying to make music that is like, oh yeah, this is mad 2004. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Or like, you know, not that, then there's some great music that I yeah. love that is very, okay, this is the 90s. But yeah. like for me personally, in my work, I really want things to speak, you know, 20 years, 100 sure. years, whatever. And so my hope is that it'll still feel very current and very new. And I think the subject matter, both fortunately and unfortunately, is going to be just as relevant.
I was going to say, particularly with the Healing Project, if that subject yeah. matter is no longer contemporary, that's a
then
good...
We can,
yeah, we're
yeah,
good.
We can get yeah. rid of all this stuff, and it'll, yeah. I'd be happy about that. But also, a lot of the material that Jack and I are creating around the Venus Project is about mental health. So that's a whole nother thing that is like really, I'm really passionate about. And I think it's really important, like for our time, our generations. And I think is something that I've been able to delve into a bit in some of the singles, some of the music that we've put out that I think people have really responded to, but we haven't given a body of work yet. So it's going to be good.
In what way is it about mental health?
I mean, a lot of the music that is a part of that project, it's about engaging with the meeting point between one's own like private experience of daily mental health, you know, wherever you're at with that, and how, where that meets with society and like just social realities. Because I think a lot of times when we talk about mental health, we talk about it in a very individualized, private way on public platforms. You know what I mean? So it's a funny thing where we don't talk about the experience of living that out in public, but we talk about it very publicly, which is a good thing. It's something we didn't used to do, but I think is healthy. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really mediated by that, because now, especially with social media and stuff, our experiences of ourselves are less private than ever. And yes. they're really affected by the world around us and the people around us and our perceptions of who we're supposed to be in society and what is good and bad, what is success and failure and all these things. And I think that that has had a really profound impact, particularly on the younger generations. And so I think it's really important to speak on that, not just in terms of this is what it feels like to deal with depression, deal with yeah. anxiety, but also what does it feel like to deal with that while also having to show up somewhere and then feel like you have to like be this version of yourself? Or what does it feel like to try to do that and feel like because of social media, like you're the only person that's not doing well, but really everybody's not doing well. They just aren't showing that.
Of course.
Know? And it's such a common experience, but somehow it's like we're not really talking about that, you know?
We're talking about a lot of things, but somehow it's not getting talked about.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Yeah. It's very present in society, but I don't know. There's a missing piece to me, and I don't know how to quite quantify that missing piece.
Is there a part of that project that is related to the Healing Project also, in the sense that we think of mental health as an individual experience, my mental health, your mental health, his mental health, but we're also all responding to a collective
yep.
environment in the same way that we think of a criminal or somebody who's incarcerated as an individual, as opposed to somebody who's dealing with a much larger totally. Context?
That is, yes, that's extremely perceptive. I totally agree with that. And I think, yes, I mean, in that way, like, I mean, number one, all the work I try to do is healing work. I definitely, like, that is my purpose, I think, in life, is just to try to do healing work through the arts. But yes, exactly what you're saying is so true, because it is a highly individual experience, but also at the same time, it's so not, and it's so mediated by one's environment, you know, the factors of your family, your community, your neighborhood, the world, your government, capitalism, like yeah. everything, you know, yeah. Celebrity culture, yes. like all these different factors are playing in, and it creates, you know, so many different pressures, I think, on a person that you have to navigate on a daily basis. I think one of the biggest ones that I'm really interested in talking about is success and failure.
Mm.
I think that's a really big thing that, like, again, I don't know why we're not really dealing with that as a society, but I think that is really, really, like, literally killing the youth. Like, it's really bad because, you know, people are out here really thinking that they will not be a success unless they're famous, you know? And mm-hmm. that is something I think is just so dangerous for many reasons. Yeah, so it's something I really want to deal with in the music.
I want to talk about that. I want to ask Jack a question. Do you want to go get water from that table? That's my question for
Jack. We talk about that in the getting hydrated, staying hydrated.
Staying hydrated is important for all of us. This is not just my hydration and your hydration. This is our hydration.
I'm going to tell you, though, that is on the real, though. What is funny about it is that, you know, while we were making this project, like Jack says, we've been working on this project and just on music about this stuff in general for like literally at least 5 years.
Wow.
Plus. Yeah, more than that, right?
Wow.
I don't want to say how long. Yeah. Because I'm sound old. But through that time, I was really conscious of all the things we're talking about from a mental and emotional perspective. But the piece I was missing was the body.
Yeah.
And that's what's really going to transform the next work, I think, is me going through this physical process with my body and understanding the fragility of the body, being more in touch, and also having the real fortune that my partner is a choreographer and a healer. She does herbal work and stuff like that. And so going through this process with her as a person that understands the body in such a deep way, it really transformed my understanding of how health, not just physical, but mental health is also a product of the body. And how important things like hydration the physical act of maintaining the body in a healthy way of being in tune, and being in tune in a way that is like itself a practice, just like we practice other things. We're in such a work culture that it's like somehow we've workified even that. Like, oh, your exercise has to also be work, or you have to forego health in order to work.
That's how I feel. I feel like
it's bad.
Obviously, I'm not the only one, and I don't even really work that hard compared to people that have to be somewhere at 7 a.m. and like all, you know. I feel that as a self-employed creative person, like even if I'm super busy, I should be able to find time for that stuff. But it's just easier somehow to like let that part go and convince myself that that's good. It means I'm busy. It means I'm like I'm focusing on the work rather than on the body.
So many musicians, I feel probably a vast majority of the musicians have horrible habits when it comes to sleep, you know, exercise, diet, being on the road, and, you know, the sort of changes your body goes through. I can't even, some of the people I admire the most when I was younger, especially coming out of college and trying to see who's really doing the work here, you know, and admiring certain folks that were in the studio, you know, sunrise to sunrise, you know, like, just, and sitting at the desk for hours and hours and hours on end and never really getting exercise and neglecting them, their bodies. And now that I'm, you know, you want to talk about age, I'm older than you and I'm feeling it.
Well, I'm older than both of you. All right. So,
but it's been long enough. Yeah. My point being now that it's been long enough for me to witness how the lack of self-care has affected us, you know?
And that ties into the idea of what success is. Again, I would like to tell myself that success would mean that I stay healthy physically, mentally, emotionally for as long as possible, that I stay creative and vital and involved and all that stuff. But there's obviously another voice in my head that's going, I should have more money and I should be more famous by now. And if I'm not, then what is this? And I think that speaks exactly to what you're talking about.
I have a few different ways that I'm trying to deal with that, which is one, and you just spoke to this because you were talking about like also just the economical context of things. Like, you know, part of it is also just as artists, we have these big dreams and we want to follow these paths. And there's not really structures that enable us to do that in sustainable and healthy ways. And so part of what I also want to do with the Healing Project is to create new frameworks where people can engage in sustainable practice and also do that in a collective model where people are also like winning together, you know? And so that's something that I have a lot of like continuous dreams of trying to build, and we're working on that. What it boils down to for me is also that if you're an artist, or really just any person, but speaking specifically to the experience of an artist for sure, you know, you have this impetus that you've had from whenever like you wanted to be that, right? And you feel compelled by this thing. And a lot of us, I don't know how much we admit it, but we don't necessarily understand what that is. And I think that's part of where it comes from, is that there's something that is more than us that is guiding us or whatever, you know, all these things where we have a passion for this thing or a calling to this thing. And once you start to follow that, then you start to think deeply about why, like, what is this? And what does this look like? And what does success or what does impact or whatever, like what is living a good life once again, we don't really have a conversation around that question in society. So we start kind of guessing. And the ways that we can best guess is to look towards people that seem to have achieved that. We don't really know if they have achieved it.
Or that they signal that they...
Yeah, they either signal it or we look to the past, like you said, and we don't really... All we know is what is remembered.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there is something important to that because I do think that, you know, for me, like having material that, I, like I said, lasts the test of time and means something and is kind of like a legacy, that does matter to me. And that is where I take, you know, a lot of cues from predecessors. But I certainly wouldn't when it comes to quality of life. You know what I mean? And I think we have to believe as artists and as people, working people, that we can achieve the things individually and collectively that we want to while also having a certain quality of life, not only because everyone deserves that, but also because if we take that as a non-negotiable, we will not accept being mistreated in the way that we've often been mistreated. And I think that's part of why the story is told about our predecessors in a certain way, is like it allows us to create a success metric that doesn't involve being treated well. Because they were not treated well, you know.
It's in the worst case, it could be romanticized even.
Yeah, exactly.
Or we tell ourselves that, well, that's just the deal that we're making.
Right.
I interviewed Daniel Lanois last year or 2 years ago, this wonderful producer and songwriter in his own right also. And I talked to him about making contemporary work. I'm reminded of it when you talk about, you know, not wanting to make anything that sounds like crazily 2004, whatever. Because Lanois uses all the same technical tools that he used essentially when he was making U2 records in the 90s. He doesn't really use computers that much, whatever. And so I said to him, how do you continue to make contemporary work using tools that most people today would say are obsolete tools? And his answer was that contemporary work was about mindset more than technology, that the tools are just a means to capture the work of the artist. And if the artist is making it today, it is by definition contemporary because it's what's happening in their world today. But Jack, if you're making work that is both trying to push the boundaries in some way or be contemporary or be new just on a technical level, do you try to make work that sounds like it can quote unquote compete or live in a world of the other records that are being made today? Or not only with this project, but in general, because you mix so many records, or is that not necessarily how you're approaching the sounds that you're looking for?
It's a difficult question to answer, I think, but it comes from the person, which I think is probably similar to what Daniel and Wild is probably trying to explain.
Yeah.
Or did explain.
Yeah.
And I try to listen, period, to Samora, for instance, or whoever it might be that is the subject. And I listen to a lot of old music, and I listen to a lot of current music, and I don't care for labels and genres. Yeah. I think it comes from the marketing world, although I still try to understand. I don't ignore them. I just look for patterns, or I look for similarities to what has happened in the past, no matter how far back, and what is currently happening and where the similarities are.
Yeah.
And I think experimentation with others, like collaboration with Samora and I would consider this relationship very collaborative and not a producer artist purely relationship. But with other artists, it may be that. In that case, sometimes it's easier to just listen and give my opinion about, you know, what I'm hearing and where I think certain changes could be made. But I think what I think I'm trying to say is that what matters more to me is that the story or the emotional content or the expression of the artist is getting through more than anything, because that sort of thing comes from the person,
right?
And not from the gear. Not from the which synth or what type of reverb.
Yeah.
I mean, you can definitely say on a technical side, like there are certain types of reverbs that when released in the 80s were very prevalent and there was an abundance of that in the mix. And you can apply that sort of technique. And sometimes I like to do that. We'll do that purposefully, you know, or intent. But
I mean, I actually think reverb is maybe reverb and low end or something, but
one of the most like
the most obvious dating
indicators.
Things. It's the thing where it's like you can basically tell,
right,
based on how much and which one it is and how big it is, like when it's from. But now we're kind of at a place where it's like everybody's referencing all the stuff all the time, so maybe we're kind of in a post history when it comes to that stuff, where there is no contemporary.
Yeah, that's great point. I think like I try to listen to all the things, but like I also have my experience as a teenager and what I listened to in the 90s and in early 2000s, and those things are definitely imprinted on me.
Yeah.
And now I've lived long enough and appreciated music long enough to see the cycles starting to repeat.
Yes.
You know, and not just, I remember being like, oh, here comes the 80s.
Yeah. No, here it's coming back. Totally.
Wait, here comes the 90s. Yep. And we're hearing 90s R&B again. And all these kids are like, yo, check this out, Grandpa. You know, like, and this is the new shit. I'm like, no, man.
But there's going to be a time, and I think we're probably there now, where if the cycle is 20 years, let's say, or 25 years, there's nothing to bring back at a certain point, because like starting, this is arbitrary, 2010, whatever, there's no more linear this followed that. It's all recycled and repurposed and kind of pastiche at a certain point. How would you bring back the 2015s?
I think technology has a role to play. Like I see people manipulating the technology to express things. Yeah. And a lot, there are some people doing some interesting things that I've not seen or heard yet.
Yeah.
That's part of it. But also, again, like the subject matter of the zeitgeist, whoever that person is, whatever, whether it's related to, it's usually related to something socially or their personal experience that I think is really at the core of something that I'm like, that's interesting. Or somebody bringing in some influence from outside of music, like from film or art, and applying it
to music
or concept or a philosophy.
That idea of zeitgeist is so interesting because it exists with a certain amount of tension with what we're talking about, which is the patience of doing these projects, where it's like, I'm going to do something that is both in the zeitgeist and also took 5 years to make. So it's especially when we're living in this cycle of immediacy. But you are in this. You're clearly, even if it is a 10-year-old project, you won't admit how long it is, but let's call it 10 years.
When do we start?
We did come back to some of the material.
Yes, no, we definitely like changed it.
Oh, you did? Yeah. You did.
Oh, 100%. We changed. We added new pieces. And a lot of music is like that. I mean, people work on things for mad long.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, people work on books for 20 years.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like films, you know. So I don't... Yeah. We're constantly, I mean, we're still tinkering. We're adding another song like next week or something.
We definitely went through the emotional gamut of like, what should we do with this song?
We've been through it all. I think also you can never predict that. I think you already lose when you try to like guess if you're going to be on time with something, because you kind of just got to pray about that. Like, you got to just hope and see what happens. Or you have to have either that, or you have to have a longer view where you say, like, my relationship is not necessarily with the culture per se, but is more with either spirit or just people. And, like, whoever gets to this, whether it's right now or in a bajillion years, like, you just never know. And so I think that, you know, you can't try to predict if it's going to make sense for everybody else, like, and you're going to be on time. But I do think that if anything, what determines that, which people I think can sometimes be the part that people miss out on. Like, for instance, if they're trying to understand why did this thing really speak to people at a moment in time? Definitely it has a lot to do with sound, for sure.
Yeah.
And it also has a lot to do with the material and how that's speaking to the moment. But it also has a lot to do with community. And I think that's the missing piece, because the reason that Tupac created what he did, like was right doing what he did, and why that sounded like it did and was what it was, or, you know, a Nina Simone or Kendrick Lamar or whatever, like Frank Ocean, that it's very much about who they were around and what they were doing. And it tends to be these people that gets pulled out of that moment and are supposed to kind of be representative of that moment. And they kind of often get taken outside as a result of the context of that community. But all these artists are informed by and a part of some type of community that's like creating that sound or, you know, contributing to it. We talk a lot about those people also that are just like really present in the creation of those things, but might not get a chance to, you know, like, we're obsessed with Shuggie Otis. He's even more obsessed than me. But like, that's like one of the goats. And he like was a big part of creating a sound of a time that he didn't necessarily get to benefit from in the popular consciousness, but that doesn't make him a less important artist. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it certainly is mediated also by technology. I mean, like Stevie wouldn't have his 70s records without the emergence of that technology, and the same with everything else. And I think the reason that that isn't important to me is that I'm the first person to say I'm a very non-technology adept, yeah, as has been evidenced by this time period. But I'm smart enough to realize that that is still important to the process. Yeah. So I'm able and lucky enough to surround myself with people like Jack or Chris, yeah, or Rafiq, who are like masters of the craft in that respect, really know what they're doing and are able to help me translate and make use of what's available.
You obviously are a very capable, smart, contemporary person who could...
Yeah, I could learn, yeah.
So the question then becomes...
Why not?
There's got to be some benefit in some way to not.
I don't know if there's a benefit except to say that I'm just interested in spending my time on other things. Yeah. I think that, number one, it's impossible for me to be a multidisciplinary artist who also is trying to make records, who's also trying to run an organization, and also really learn the craft in the way that, yeah, Jack has learned, yeah, it. Like, it's just impossible for me. And so I'm just like, okay, I'm going to focus on that. I really need to spend my time, you know, engaged in that part of the craft. And then, like I said, collaborate with others who are engaged in that part of the craft. And I feel the same about film. Like, I have a collaborator, Christian Padron, who's, yeah, like, amazing cinematographer, who we make all the films together that we create. You know, I rely on him in the technical realm and collaborate with him in much the same way I collaborate with Jack. I think that's the main reason, because I agree with you. I certainly could spend the time, and I would like to at some point, and I'm engaged in that process. But for me, I just kind of try to see myself or my role as a little bit more privileged to be able to be in the clouds, in a sense where it's like, I can think big and I can survey things, yeah, and I can try to express what I think is honest in that context. And then I can have a lot of people that help me to engage in the details around how to like make that expression come to life.
I don't think you should be responsible either for or having control of all of those things. I have done it. I have tried to do it, and I don't like that, or I prefer not to, you know what I mean? Aside from like the collaborative aspect, yeah, of it, it's like, at the end of the day, I always try to remind myself, like, oh, there's a reason they call it playing music. Like, let's go in the studio and play. So I like to put things in front of him that he has no experience with and be like, try this out.
Totally.
You know? I mean, Miles Davis was an influence on me, yeah, and we started putting a Rhodes or a Whirly or whatever in front of Chick or,
sure,
Keith or,
so
whatever.
How are you going to deal with this? Let's, yeah, see what, yeah, you do with this, yeah, tool. Yeah.
And discomfort, you know?
Yes.
And introducing, but... I don't think it feels like discomfort. It feels like discovery. Exactly. That's the most, and even for myself, like in my creative process, I've gotten the most fulfilling or exciting and fun results out of exploring something.
There's new. Always that thing where you don't quite know how it works,
yeah,
and you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah. You can look at a piece of equipment like, yeah, oh man, this is a piece of technology, yeah, and this is overwhelming and I don't know. But as soon as you start touching it and making sound, yeah, then you feel like a child again.
Yes. Well, that's what you're trying to get back to, the childlike, yeah, thing. This is a question I've just been asking. It's not a super deep question. Lifestyle stuff, diet, sleep, love that kind of stuff.
I'm this right now.
Let's talk about it.
This is great. Okay. I'm going to give some recommendations.
Okay.
Yes. This is obviously provided. Wait, number one, my prayer for everyone is that they have health care, and we need universal health care in the United States. Okay, that's first and foremost. I understand also that a lot of this in the moment is like mediated by finances and what people can afford to do and not do, and that's really messed up, and I totally acknowledge that. That being said, if you can afford to do these things, they're very, very helpful. And have been really helpful in my life. Alexander Technique, amazing. I have an amazing person who, you know, Lori Schiff, was an incredible teacher of Alexander Technique, who's helped me so much in my recovery. Also, you know, I was lucky enough to grow up in a family that's really like, my parents are very healthy in terms of like being very specific about diet and things like that. So no dairy, no processed sugar, trying to be low on the grains, like it's hard. But the biggest change for me has been just trying to cook more. It's really hard as like a touring musician, just, you know, musician in general. A lot of us are always on the go and we have to just like eat out all the time. And I think that can be not great for your body, even if you're not just eating like bad stuff. just because it's always like processed and just finding the time to cook, being the type of artist that's not like, I'm too good for this, I'm not supposed to do household, you know, like that's silly. Like we should be.
Have you felt that in the past? I understand that.
I definitely like bought into that when I was, when I was younger, like I definitely bought into that. Like all of this is like a waste of my time. I'm supposed to only be thinking about, you know, the art. And it's like, dude, you gotta do the laundry and cook.
Nobody, you know, thought, like, did Sonny Stitt clean his own toilet, you know, or what's going
it's
on?
Like, come on, like you gotta, you know, gotta be clean. Yeah. And also not only that, but it, like you said, it's quality of life. It actually enhances your quality of life. It can be very calming. It can be almost meditative if you allow it to be that. And it can provide balance in your life. And then I'm a big proponent of therapy of many different kinds. Talk therapy, somatic therapy, herbalism. Like I said, I'm lucky, you know, my partner's an herbalist, but just all these kind of elements, if you have access to these things, I think they really make all the difference in the world. I wish that everybody was able to actually engage in these practices, because we have so much we're always holding in and trying to figure out, and just having the space in all these different ways to, you know, go through the process with stuff on the weekly basis is like critical. I think that it helps us treat ourselves and others, most importantly, in a much kinder, more loving way.
That's wonderful.
I'm going to feel like a major hypocrite right now, because these are things I strive for, but that I'm not always practicing. But hydration. Let's come back. I guess. Hydrate. Cheers. Cheers. Yeah. I'm cheersing group, with water. I don't know. No, I don't believe.
That was a rumor created by the alcohol lobby.
Sleep. Sleep. Consistent sleep. Like, striving for that, but like going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, getting up early, and meditation.
Yeah.
I think is extremely beneficial. If not for anything, just to get away from our phones, from computer screens. You know, I've gone through moments where I have not given myself a moment in the day without exposure to a screen or a conversation with another human or a book or a podcast or something, you know what I mean? Without some sort of stimuli at all times. And until I get in my bed to go to sleep and I'm like, my mind is racing a million miles an hour. And I realize like, oh, this is the first time I have not engaged in some sort of activity. I really start to feel it after a while. So walking. I know these are simple
yeah, these
things.
Are, you know,
like,
these are not original thoughts, but it doesn't mean that they're not important.
No, that's what I really try to get back to, is simplifying my life. Things have gotten very complicated over the years, and so I'm trying to keep things as simple as possible at all times. And like getting, specifically when it comes to walking, like getting up from the computer or from your instrument and walking for 10, 15 minutes and coming back to it, because I really enjoy talking and walking and talking.
That's talk about goals.
Yeah.
I want to get to the place where I could take a walk without my phone making a phone call.
Yeah, sure.
Like just walking in silence, because I think that's when you actually start to do some work.
I actually, like, I'm for sure. Yeah. I mean, I have some of my best conversations when I'm walking, though, and I have some of my best thoughts when I'm walking without listening to things, you know.
But I do encourage people to listen to my podcast while they take a walk.
Yeah, that's
maybe somebody's walking
to
right now, listening to this
podcast.
Yeah, listen
podcast
to this conversation and take a walk.
Yeah, a lot of young musicians, students, and things that I've come in contact with, they're eager to create something, and they may be struggling with finding something to speak about or just to write about, and they may have an immense amount of skill and talent, but they don't feel like there's meaning to their work. And I try to talk to them about what's going on in their personal life or what's been going on with them day to day, or what their, you know, their past or something. It's just good to get out and experience life, because it took me a long time to realize that the conversations we're having in our music are related to our life experience.
Absolutely. I mean, as a songwriter myself, I found one of the most challenging moments in my life to be the most, ultimately the most creative, which is when I found myself in a stable marriage and I was no longer writing about the pursuit of love and the loss of love.
Sure.
And it was like, now I can actually look at the world and think about what else do I care about, because this is not the dominant subject in my life all the time.
Right.
And I actually found that as unsexy as I thought it was, right. it got interesting at that point.
Yeah, and yeah.
It wasn't the topic.
I mean, you know, take care of your bodies, yeah. but go, you know, do
yeah.
something.
Yeah, do something else.
don't go do a bunch of drugs or anything like that. You know what I'm saying? Don't
kids just like stay in school.
That's not what I'm saying. Yeah, just go and have some new experiences, try some different things, put yourself in a, you know, uncomfortable place that you're not used to. You know, yeah, so have something to talk about.
I'll be the first to say that I agree with that. I will also, I think people would be surprised also, but just to what you're speaking yeah. about, I'm not the most adventurous person. I don't like, I'm probably a more, by general metrics, like boring person than like a lot of other people. But I think that I'm still able to speak about a lot of different subjects. Mm-hmm. And it's like you said, I just think more than anything, this is more of a songwriting thing, but then like maybe a health thing. But like there's so much out there when we stretch ourselves. And I think that's part yeah. of what you're talking yeah. about is that, you know, it can be easy to stop at the first thing, whether that's the first level of where you're at emotionally yeah. or whether that's the experiences or the music you're comfortable listening to or mm-hmm. the subject matter that you're used to hearing, because yeah. a lot of things are very homogenous right now.
Yes.
But it's like the biggest thing to do is a push at least a level, if not two, past that and to dig deeper and to say, what's here beyond that? You know, and I think that's where you start to find the really transformative things in your life and in the artwork, because there's so much to engage with that's not at that first level.
Let's leave it there. Some more Pinder Hughes, Jack DeBow.
Thank you, Leo.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you.
There they were, my friends. Samora Pinder Hughes and Jack DeBow. What a beautiful couple of human beings. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.